Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge, simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back, everyone, to the Deep Dive. Today, we're cracking open a really fascinating piece of history. It's a book that kind of exploded onto the scene back in the 1830s.
Yeah, it really shaped how a lot of Europeans, especially the British elite, saw the young United States.
We're talking about Francis Trollope's The Domestic Manners of the Americans. It's quite sharp, sometimes savagely witty.
Absolutely. And it's really key if you want to grasp the sort of enduring tension within American culture itself. You know, Trollope arrived during the Jacksonian era.
Right, the age of like intense populism, frontier democracy.
Exactly. And she came expecting, maybe, this idealized republic based on liberty and equality. But what she ended up delivering was this, well, pretty scathing report.
Scathing is a good word for it.
Yeah, basically arguing that this big push for social equality had a real cultural cost.
So our goal today isn't just to rehash old gossip from the 1830s. We want to really unpack her core argument.
Which is pretty controversial even now.
Definitely. The idea that political equality, you know, great ideal on paper, might actually lead to a kind of coarseness or materialism, or even just a general lowering of standards.
Mm-hmm. And we want to look at what her observations might maybe tell us today about things like conformity, populism, public standards, that sort of thing.
Okay, so before we dive into the book itself, let's talk about the author, Fanny Trollope.
Right, Frances Milton Trollope. Born 1779. And it's important to know she wasn't like a scholar or a political analyst.
No, not at all. She was an English gentlewoman, middle-aged by the time she came to America. And she came purely out of, well, financial desperation, really.
Yeah, that's the key. She wasn't doing a grand tour. She moved her family to the U.S. between 1827 and 1831.
And her plan was to set up a business, right, in Cincinnati, Ohio, which was basically the frontier back then.
A very ambitious and ultimately doomed business called Trollope's Bazaar.
Oh, the bazaar. It sounds so out of place.
It totally was. Imagine trying to sell, like, fine European silks and fancy decorative goods in a muddy, bustling, very practical American frontier town. It was a complete financial flop.
But it's such a perfect metaphor for her whole experience, isn't it?
It really is. You have her very refined, sort of hierarchical English background crashing headlong into this raw, commercial, aggressively democratic American culture.
So she's not some detached observer jotting notes from a distance.
Not at all. She's a participant who failed, and failed spectacularly. And the book is written with this kind of passionate, almost satirical energy of someone who felt completely let down, disillusioned.
Which leads us right into her main argument about America.
Yeah, her big thesis.
Yeah.
Trollope basically concluded that America's passionate embrace of radical egalitarianism, this idea that everyone is equal in every way, was actually undermining the very foundations of culture and refinement.
How so? What was the connection for her?
Well, she believed that without some kind of established social hierarchy, you know, an aristocracy or at least a recognized cultural elite, there was no standard to aspire to.
Okay. So if everyone's constantly insisting, I'm just as good as you are, then...
Then the default standard becomes sort of the lowest common denominator, mm-hmm. maybe just the average. She saw American culture becoming coarse and, well, mediocre because nobody was looking up to anything higher.
Interesting. So the book isn't really about politics or the Constitution.
No, not directly. It's framed as a travelogue, but it's really a social critique focusing on these domestic manners.
Everyday stuff.
Exactly. How people eat, talk, interact, treat each other. She thought that was where you saw the real soul of the nation, not in its, you know, founding documents.
So she writes about her journey, starting in New Orleans, going up the Mississippi.
Right, to Cincinnati, which really becomes ground zero for her complaints. And then later she travels east to places like Baltimore and New York.
And who was she writing this for?
Primarily for a British audience. Specifically, she wanted to challenge the kind of romantic, idealized view of American democracy that was popular among some British liberals at the time. She was basically saying, look, this is what it's really like on the ground.
Okay, let's get into some of those specifics, especially from the frontier. What really shocked her in Cincinnati?
Oh, plenty. The informality, the sheer focus on money-making. But it was the table manners, or lack thereof, that really seemed to horrify her. She judged the whole republic by how they ate dinner.
And what did she see?
She described meals eaten in near total silence. People just focused on, like, shoveling food down as fast as possible.
Efficiency over conversation.
Totally. No ceremony, no social grace. And then there was the thing everyone remembers from the book, the tobacco spitting.
Oof.
Yes. Spitting everywhere, in public spaces, theaters even, she claimed, around the dinner table. It was constant and, to her, utterly disgusting.
That's silence and speed at the table. It connects back to her theme about commercialism, right?
Absolutely. It's like time spent on chatting or being polite was time you weren't using to make money or get back to work. Utility over everything.
And this lack of social ritual, this sort of bluntness, it caused friction elsewhere too.
Yeah.
Like with servants.
Oh, definitely. That was a huge issue for her. In a society insisting on absolute equality, how do you manage relationships like master and servant?
Right, because the American help, as they were called, wouldn't see themselves as servants.
Exactly. They refuse to act subordinate. Trollope describes them as often defiant, unhelpful, because this whole I'm as good as you attitude just killed any sense of deference or, you know, fulfilling a service role willingly.
So instead of a smooth hierarchy, you just got awkwardness, resentment.
Constant friction, yeah. Unpleasantness. Because if you kill deference, people just end up constantly asserting their status against each other. Now, interestingly, coming from a woman, she was also pretty critical of American women.
Really? How so?
Well, she saw them as being put on this kind of superficial pedestal. Lots of exaggerated chivalry, you know? But functionally, she felt they were shut out of intellectual life. Their lives were confined to housework, raising children, and this intense piety. She found their education really shallow.
And she connected this lack of intellectual engagement to religion.
Very much so. She argued this cultural vacuum was often filled by really extreme forms of evangelical religion. She attended some of these camp meetings, these big outdoor revivals.
And she wasn't impressed.
She was horrified. She described them as scenes of mass hysteria, pure emotionalism, completely lacking in intellectual substance or, you know, aesthetic dignity.
So it was like emotion filling the space where art or philosophy should be.
That was her take, yes. Especially controlling the lives of women, she saw it as deeply anti-intellectual, almost frightening in its fervor.
Okay, so safe to say she did not enjoy Cincinnati. Did things improve when she went east to cities like Baltimore, Philadelphia?
Slightly. She acknowledged the cities were a bit more civilized, better houses, more fashionable clothes.
There's always a but with Trollope.
But yeah. Still lacking, in her view, the genuine cultural depth, the ingrained traditions of Europe. She noticed this kind of anxious obsession with status, everyone trying very hard to look rich and refined, but without the, you know, effortless confidence she associated with a real aristocracy.
And this is where she talks about the tyranny of public opinion.
Exactly. Even in the supposedly more sophisticated East, she felt that conformity ruled. Everyone was terrified of offending the majority view.
So you couldn't really be eccentric or have unpopular intellectual ideas if you wanted to get ahead.
That was her argument. Public opinion acted like an absolute monarch, demanding conformity. She wasn't impressed by the political leaders either, found them kind of crude, even Andrew Jackson.
Saw politics as just materialistic.
Pretty much. Focused on practical matters, money, not grand ideas, lacking statesmanship as she saw it.
But there's one area where her critique goes beyond just social observation, isn't there? Slavery.
Yes, absolutely. And this is crucial. She witnessed slavery firsthand, particularly in the South. And her condemnation is absolute, uncompromising.
What does she say about it?
She recounts horrific stories of brutality, families being torn apart. She called it the fundamental moral hypocrisy of the American Republic.
Arguing it basically invalidated all their claims about liberty and equality.
Incisely. You know, her complaints about spitting might seem trivial or snobbish, but her moral outrage over slavery was deeply felt and powerfully argued. It gives the book a weight it might otherwise lack.
Okay, so let's pull back a bit. If we think about the lasting themes from Trollope, what are the big takeaways for us now?
Well, first, there's that core critique of radical egalitarianism. The idea that insisting everyone is equal in all respects can actually discourage excellence and undermine standards.
Does make you think, doesn't it? In our own lives, maybe at work or socially, do we sometimes shy away from upholding standards because we don't want to seem elitist?
Right. Or confuse just being difficult or rude with being, you know, a genuine individual thinker. It's a tricky balance.
And our second theme, the tyranny of public opinion.
That feels incredibly relevant today, maybe even more so than in the 1830s. Her idea that without a formal hierarchy, the majority view becomes this all-powerful force demanding conformity.
It sounds a lot like online culture, doesn't it? Cancel culture, groupthink?
Exactly. The fear of saying the wrong thing, of offending the prevailing consensus, can stifle real debate and nuance. It's like we substitute genuine discussion with just trying not to get attacked by the mob.
Okay, and the third big one. Commercialism over culture.
Yeah, the obsession with money making the dollar is the darling, as she put it, leaving little room or respect for arts, intellectual pursuits, or just leisure for its own sake. Utility trumps beauty.
We definitely still wrestle with that. How we measure success for our cities, our schools, even ourselves, often comes down to economic metrics, doesn't it?
Yeah, often overlooking culture, well-being, public spaces, things that enrich life but don't necessarily show up on a balance sheet. It's that constant tension.
Some of her lines are just incredibly memorable, too. They really stick with you.
Oh, they do. They're blunt, to say the least.
Like her overall summary of America, she just lays it out. I do not like them. I do not like their principles. I do not like their manners. I do not like their opinions.
Talk about comprehensive rejection. It really shows her critique was total behavior, politics, worldview, the whole package. Nothing was spared.
Except maybe the landscape, as you mentioned.
Right. She did admire the scenery sometimes, but not the people in it.
And then there's her core idea linking equality and manners. The I'm as good as you feeling is a bar to the progress of refinement.
Yeah, that's her diagnosis right there. For her, social harmony needed some level of accepted hierarchy and difference. Replace that with constant defiant status assertion, and social life just becomes grating, unpleasant.
And finally, that really provocative challenge to American liberty itself. All the freedom enjoyed in America is enjoyed solely by the disorderly at the expense of the orderly.
Oof, yeah. She's basically reframing freedom not as this great virtue, but as a license for the rude and crude to annoy everyone else. It perfectly captures the clash between her worldview and the American one she encountered.
So, putting aside whether we agree with her conclusions, how can we actually use Trollope's perspective today? What's the practical application?
I think the biggest thing is developing cultural self-awareness. Her book is a masterclass in how our own background shapes what we see and judge.
Right. Her disgust over spitting or eating habits says as much about 1830s British norms as it does about America.
Exactly. So when you travel or interact with people from different backgrounds, Trollope reminds you to question your own assumptions about what's normal or polite. Your norms aren't universal truths.
It also kind of encourages you to be more observant, doesn't it? To adopt her method, even if you reject her attitude?
Yes. Scrutinize the everyday stuff. What would a modern Trollope say about how we use our phones in public? Or how we interact in online forums? These seemingly small things still reveal a lot about our underlying values.
Maybe the most important thing is the historical context it provides.
Definitely. The clash she described between populist, egalitarian standards and more traditional, maybe elitist cultural standards, that tension is still completely central to our political and cultural debates today.
It's the same argument, just in different clothes.
Pretty much. It's been going on since Jacksonian America, at least.
You know, what really struck me rereading this was how much she makes you realize that a nation's character isn't just in its grand ideals or founding myths.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the tiny details, how people eat, talk, spend their time. The dinner table really is a kind of battlefield for the national soul in her telling.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. And I think the book's lasting value, whether you love it or hate it, is that it forces that uncomfortable conversation about democracy and culture.
Of achieving political equality might have.
Well, cultural trade-offs. Right. It makes us confront that complexity. Progress in one area might mean losing something else, like traditional forms of refinement. It teaches you the value of really looking closely, observing the details, even if ultimately you come to very different conclusions than she did. It demands cultural humility, perhaps.
A fascinating, if prickly, perspective to consider. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.